Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for August 10th. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and back with me from wherever he was last week is Jim Allen. How you doing, buddy? Feeling better?
I'm feeling good. I'm vertical. Last week I was vertigo.
Yeah, well, we missed you. We missed you, but Jason did a good job of filling
in. He did. I love the show. I did love the show. It was I love Jason, and I like what he brings. So it was fun to listen to. I got to sort of kind of like enjoy it without any of the hassle of actually recording it.
Hassle?
Well,
wait a minute, man.
For the listeners, the hassle is that
your foot from your mouth.
That's not a problem. I do it on an hourly basis, dude.
Only hourly, you think? Okay, go ahead.
Hashtag.
Oh, that's rich coming from you. The hassle is that we record after I finish work Sunday night, typically. And it's a time hassle. It's a time conundrum, usually.
Yeah.
Which is why we're recording Sunday morning, because there's stuff going on at work that's going to keep me there past midnight tonight. So
So I appreciate you getting up early. Thanks a lot.
Well, I do too. I appreciate the fact that I can get up early. it's like a tribute to life. Can get up early, it means you're still alive.
All right, well, you keep that coffee flowing, you keep doing that.
It's my lifeblood, baby.
On this week's show, we've got an interview with Rick Vandenhurk of the Hawks, and we're going to talk about the Lions skid and box and answer some great listener questions. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
All right. I went out to QVC Marine Field yesterday. It was mercifully not brutally hot. And which was my fear going out there, because it's been toasty in the Tokyo area. And yep. That's a long parched walk from the station when it's hot. Yeah. Anyway, so I went out there and I was worried about the time, and I got a chance, and I say got a chance is big, to talk to Rick Vandenhurk, because he's been really hard to get to. When the Hawks have played up here before, he'd been on the minor league team.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he came up, then he was called up on June 14th, and he pitched twice. But when he was – and then after he pitched twice and won his first two games, he was sent back down to the minors.
Right.
And that's when the Hawks were up here, and I saw him a couple of times. And then he came back from the minors in that week, 10 days later, and then he began his sort of path to – monthly stardom. So he's been very effective. He's right now, between the minors and the Pacific League, he's 10-1. He went 5-1 in the minors with a 1.37 ERA,
mm-hmm,
in the Western League, which is good, but it's the Western League, which is a pitcher's league, and the Hawks minor league park is like an airport. You know, it's like, see if you can hit this one over the fence. what? Let's see if you can see the fence.
Yeah.
Okay.
The fence again.
Exactly. There's one there. We trust us. Okay. So anyway, I did get a chance to see him. Now, here's the thing. They named him as the Pacific League Pitcher of the Month on Friday. They made the announcement, of course, to the media and the reporters on Thursday night.
Uh-huh.
And now he was scheduled to pitch on Friday at Chiba, and he did pitch. And because he was going to pitch, they didn't want to, you know, have the normal Friday announcement day press conference. So they met him in Fukuoka. They did it in Fukuoka the night before.
Right.
I asked our beat writer, can you get me the English quotes? He went, well, I heard him speaking English.
Nice.
Yeah, and he's a good, great guy, but he says, oh, you can't use the Japanese, the English to Japanese to English. And I don't know. So anyway, I thought, well, that's not going to work. And then if he pitches on Friday, he'll be practicing on Saturday, and he won't be available Sunday, which was my target day to go to Chiba. So I went out on Saturday, and all these troubles talking to him, and to make it was it's like it's been a it's been like trying to find Dr. Schweitzer in Africa. And then I walk into this QVC Marine Field, and he's waiting at the entrance.
Like he's waiting for you.
Yeah, Dr. Livingston in Africa, excuse my mixed metaphor. And it was like Dr. Livingston, I presume. And he was, to complete the story, he was there because he had finished practice and he was about to leave. Because pitchers have the day off, you know, he's not going to do anything. So he was about to leave and he was at that moment greeting one of the Marines players. And I'm thinking, oh, is this one of the guys he knew from like the Hawaiian Winter League or from the minor leagues or something, or he didn't pitch in the Independent Korea or somewhere. And it was Ikuhiro Kyota.
Oh, whom he hit in the face the previous night.
Yeah, that's right. And he was wearing a surgical mask to cover the scars.
Mm.
And he said, oh, he's fine. And anyway, they had a happy little greeting and Kyota looked pretty ganky and lively for you non-Japanese speakers. If
thank
you. And so I said, can you talk now? And he said, sure, let's talk. And we talked and talked. And we just spoke there in the entrance lobby at Chiba Marine, the stadium formerly known as Chiba Marine Stadium.
QVC
Marine Field. And he was it was great. It was great with his time. Now, I guess the other thing I want to say is that because I'd been wanting to speak to this guy since I found out he was going to sign with the Hawks in December.
Mm.
He had he's a real interesting career. We ended up talking more about his career than anything he's done in Japan. I had all his background stuff I wanted to get through, and after 20 minutes talking with him, and I've only seen him pitch a couple of times on TV, so I didn't have specific questions about his pitching as much as, you know, the route that he took to get here.
Right.
So I apologize for the lack of specifics and details. But now that he's part of the Hawks rotation for the time being, part of the 7-day weekly rotation and not the 10-day you're up from the minors and now you're gone, Yakult Swallows Yamanaka rotation. Okay, let's listen to what Rick has to say and not what I have to say. Our guest this week on the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast is Rick Vandenhurk of the SoftBank Hawks. Thank you for spending time and being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, no, it's a pleasure. We've hard to track you down when you're in Fukuoka and spending so much time in the Western League. But now you're up at the roster for good, it looks like.
Yeah, it looks like that, yeah.
How was it for you to succeed at the first team, succeed in the minors, succeed at the first team level, and then get a ticket back to the minors over and over again?
I just, you know, that stuff don't bother me. I just focus on what I have to do, and that's prepare myself the best way for every single game, wherever that game is. And I just focus on that and making sure that I throw strikes and do the little things right in order to put the team in a position to win the game. So I focus on that, and, you know, that's how it played out.
Now, it must be hard because you were essentially on a 10-day rotation there for a while, on 9 days rest.
Yeah, you know, those are things that can happen here, so I'm aware of that. And so in between, you know, you tweak a little bit with your preparation in between. But, you know, like I said, you know, you keep your focus and you work on the things you have to work on in between starts and make sure you are as best prepared as you can for the next time you're on the mound.
Seems like the Hawks are doing that. Yeah, they did that at the end of last season, you know, using the farm team to bolster their rotation, having two or three guys on the farm team. And this year it's been you and Jason and then now Setsu. And, you know, Setsu has come back twice and he's done very well. So it seems to be working for everybody, that little extra rest.
I don't know. You know, I think all of us want to, you know, have a consistent games, you know, right. as a starting pitcher. So if it happens, it happens. You know, we're professional enough to make sure we adjust and get the right things, you know. I mean, Setsu, he's an ace. So, you know, he knows how to handle everything. And that's a good part to see. And for me, I can learn off that, you know.
Yeah, it was great to see him have that game the other night.
Absolutely. Really good to see.
Okay, now, first of all, your father was a baseball coach. So you grew up in the Netherlands as a baseball player. When did you first start playing?
I was about 4 years old.
Holy smokes.
My dad was a baseball coach, but he was into athletics.
Oh, okay.
In general, you know, he had me doing judo. We had me doing long track speed skating. I was playing soccer a lot with my friends outside. So I did, growing up, I did multiple sports. And later on, when I was about 12 years old, I just focused myself on the game of baseball. And, yeah.
Yeah, Luke Van Mill told me he started out in judo as well.
Right, so. Yeah. It's a popular sport.
Oh, is this? I'm not that familiar with it. So, okay. So you grew up in the Netherlands and you were playing ball in the Netherlands. You were scouted there. But you were playing, you know, Netherlands baseball is very strong.
It's not quite as strong, I feel like, compared to other countries that can play year-round, you know. That's okay. The thing. In Netherlands, we cannot play year-round.
Right.
And we have to go indoors, which makes it tough to play games and to get good practices in. And so we do the best we can. And, you know, we perform well on tournaments. And I think the reason we do is that we have a very strong preparation.
Ah.
So that's a big, big boost for us.
Yeah, when I saw the Europe team here with Steve Janssen was running that, I saw some practices I'd never seen before.
Right.
Like doing infield, sheet infield, or maybe it was PFP. It was the pitcher's fielding practice with three pitchers and three guys hitting fungos.
Yes.
One on the left, one in the middle, and one on the right side. Never seen that.
Yeah, he's got, you know, he's always thinking about new ways to do things, and I think that's a good thing. You know, it keeps the baseball brain fresh, and you know, he does a good job of that.
Yeah, it was a pleasure having him over here. Now, what was the injury that kept you out of playing for the European team?
Yeah, I tweaked my hamstring. Okay. You know, we were in Miyazaki during spring camp, and I was running sprints, and you know, that's when I start feeling, and I was like, that didn't feel right, and I just kind of went day to day, and so the next day, I had to throw in a game. I threw one inning, but it was really bothering me, and. And so I had to take a little bit of rest to make sure to heal it up.
Okay. So, yeah, it's unfortunate you missed the European games.
That would have been fun, you know. That would have been real fun. I was looking forward to playing in that. And, you know, it can happen when you're playing professional sports. So.
Yeah, but so you're you're not the first Dutch international to play here because Vladimir Valentin has had some success.
Right.
The first guy from the Netherlands, and
correct.
We've also got Alessandro Maestri from Italy. So
yeah.
Japan's becoming very international now. We have a couple of Australian internationals as
yeah.
well.
Yeah,
and it's really nice to see the baseball grow. You know how the growth of baseball international is showing up in MPB.
Absolutely, I think you know. I think international baseball is getting stronger. You know, with the exposure that's been giving. You know, to there's a major league teams play games in Australia. They play games in Japan. They're looking to go to Europe. You know, we had a lot of events in Europe for to bring major leaguers over, and so you know, it inspires kids and inspires coaches, and they learn off each other. And I think that's why the talent overall has been growing, and that's good to see.
And with the Dutch team, you get to work with some pretty good coaches. I
absolutely,
know Albert Blijleven was a pitching coach.
Absolutely,
and would you
yeah.
pick up anything from him?
Of course, you know he's a legend. His curveball was, you know, the best curveball in the game, you know. So he told me about that. He taught me some tricks, you know. And
I was about to ask yeah. if he taught you how to scuff it.
No, he didn't teach me that. Just like grip wise and what he was thinking and where his locations and where he would be looking at to start his curveball off and you know different kind of counts. So I learned a lot from him in the short period I worked with him.
Yeah, he's really good at explaining things. I
yeah, he is.
Talking.
Absolutely.
Just having chats.
Yeah,
him.
And he's fun to be around, you know.
He yeah. seems so. Yeah. So now, what did international ball teach you, or what can you apply that you learned in international baseball?
I mean, every country plays a different style
yeah.
of game, and that's good to see. You know, Japan is different than Korea. Korea is different than the United States, and you know, you play in all various countries, and you pick things up, and you learn, and you pay attention, and you're open, and you know, to any style, and I think that's the most important thing that has helped me. That I've been open, you know, to accepting the styles that have been played. You know, so.
Okay, now this year we've got the Premier 12 coming up. You gonna play?
If they
call your name.
Right. If they call my name, then I definitely would play. I think if everything is okay with the team and stuff like that, you know, it should be good.
Yeah, that's one of the good things about playing in Japan is there's not that issue about the team not letting you play
right.
unless you're hurt.
Yes, right.
Because they want to send their best guys too.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, that's a good thing to see. But for now, you know, I have to focus first on the season and finishing strong. We want to win the championship. So, you know, we're working hard towards that and once we realize that goal, you know, I'll take a look at the next step. So.
Okay, now you've got a new manager here who's a pitcher, right. And I've everybody with the Hawks tells me he's really hard on the pitchers. He's really strict in terms of conditioning and running. And
yeah, he's got a good regimen. You know, he's a Hall of Famer here, or I think he's going to be.
He's going to be a Hall of Famer next year.
Yeah, next year. Sorry. So you know, he's a legend, and he's been through it all. He's seen it all. He's done it all. So it's good to learn from him and to pay attention, you know, to what he does. And he helps us a lot. So, yeah, I think it's good.
Yeah, I think one of the issues with him, I know when he came to camp, was no injuries. And you guys have been very injury-free. I mean, other than Honda stepping on the base. And
yeah, there's been a couple minor things. But other than that, I think everybody's in good shape.
Yeah, so, okay, so how was the adjustment coming from Korea to Japan? And you mentioned that Korea and Japan are different. Now, what ways are they different? Can you explain that?
Well, the cultures are different, sure. You know. Just adjusting to the Japanese culture, that also takes time, you know. I was in Korea, and after 2 years, you know, you are creating your comfort zone, and then you get taken out of that, and you go to Fukuoka, and then you're uncomfortable again, you know, for a good period of time, and you try to make it comfortable again by going and doing things and learning the whole organization and all the players and all the coaches and all the trainers and so forward. So, you know, it's been an adjustment, and I've been very fortunate to have a great wife that's with me, and she's always supportive, and you know, that helps a lot. So we have great foreign players here that've been in Japan. Mm-hmm. All foreign players that are here, except for me, been in Japan for I think 5 years or more.
Yeah.
So you know, that obviously helps a lot to learn from them as well, and you know, they give me advice. So that's great.
Okay, I ask, who's the Japanese guy on the team who's the funniest?
Probably Machi. Yeah. Matsuda. he's awesome.
That.
Yeah.
Everyone says that. It always looks like he's had about 10 cups of coffee too many.
Yeah, he's got a lot of energy, you know, and he fires us up. So he's really fun to play with.
Do you speak any English? Has he learned any Dutch yet?
Yeah, no Dutch yet. We just stick to English, yeah.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much for that. And we'll look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right, well, thanks a lot, Rick. And I'm really looking forward to talking to you again when I can talk to something other than, you know, how you got to Japan.
All right. Well, thank you, Rick, and I'm looking forward to meeting you. I know I always say that, so don't say anything, Jim.
You're certainly going to look up to him.
Yeah, I know he's a tall guy, so.
Yeah, 6'6".
Yeah. Yeah, he stands tall on the mound, too, so.
So, what'd you get out of Mr. Vandenhert besides learning how to pronounce his name? Although I didn't give him his first name, which is Henricus.
Oh, no. I'll go with Rick.
I will too.
Well, I really appreciate you doing the interview, and as usual, you did a good job. I would say the biggest thing for me was when you tried to compliment the Dutch team by saying that the Dutch team has been really good in international play, and it just seemed like he didn't share that view at all. I got the sense he was trying to say, hey, the team hasn't won. What are you talking about? You know, we're out there to win. We're out there to win these you know, the WBC, we're not just out there to beat Cuba and look good or win a couple games here and look good. We want to win the tournament. And the team's gotten close, and I think expectations are kind of high, especially when they bring a lot of talent. And I think they impressed a lot of reporters who covered Samurai Japan in the WBC that was played here last time in Japan. So, I got the impression that he's like, well, we're not just out here to play well and make the world respect us. We're out here to win.
Well, I don't think he was with the Dutch team in 2013.
I don't think so either. My impression was that
right.
Whether he's on the team or not, thanks
right.
for the compliment.
But he has pitched a lot with the Dutch team in the past, and the Dutch team, apart from the WBC, has been very successful in international competition. I mean, in the terms of they do quite well. They're the strongest team in Europe, which is not saying nothing.
Not saying nothing. It's good use of the double negative, and I agree.
Okay, so I meant that in the sense of they're the best team from a country which doesn't have a big baseball playing tradition.
And I just think his attitude was, you know, thanks, but we don't have any Olympic medals as far as I know.
No.
And we don't have a WBC championship, and we, you know, I haven't seen.
Oh, they were semifinalists in 2013. Now he did pitch in 2009, In fact, he was their last starter in 2009. They lost in pool two.
Mm-hmm.
They cleared pool one, and then they lost both the United States and the Netherlands in their quarterfinal round, lost their first game, and they had to play each other. They had a double elimination.
Mm-hmm.
And he started against the U.S., and they lost 9-3.
Okay.
And the U.S. went on to reach the semifinals, where they were beaten by Japan.
Right. I also like the answer to the question about the 10-day rotation situation, and I think it was almost as if it seemed to me the way he responded to your question was that he kind of expected that when he signed. That he knew there was going to be some kind of logjam in terms of pitching talent, and that they were going to. I tended to think, as soon as I heard that Kudo, the manager, Kimiyasu Kudo, has had a plan in place from, you know, the time he signed the contract to become the manager. He said, look, we're going to conserve our pitchers, or we're going to have a lot and we're going to be able to conserve them, so let's do it. Maybe it's not a plan for conservation so much as it's a plan for this fact that they have a lot of pitching talent. I don't know which one comes first, or the egg.
We saw this last year with manager Koji Akiyama cycling through his pitchers after Kenji Otonari came back from his back surgery. And that, I don't know if that worked out well. It's weird, but it's worked out well this year, because every guy who's gone dead, the three guys we're talking about are Rick Vandenhurk, Jason Standridge, and Tadashi Setsu. All of them came back, and when they came back from the minors, they were like, they had found a new gear. And I won't say that about Vandenhurk, because the only reason he found a new gear is because he was just starting out and he was just warming up.
Right.
You know, that sort of two runs in six innings kind of wussy first, you know, debut when he won his first game was nothing to what we saw afterwards.
Yeah.
But Setsu came back and he had a shutout until the ninth inning. He threw his first complete game victory in 2 years, and he had a shutout going for some point.
Yeah.
So that was working last year, and he's done that, but it's worked. And I had the impression that before I actually looked at the numbers, I had the impression he'd been up and he'd gone back twice, and he only went back once.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. It just seemed that way because of the schedule that I was trying to meet him. I kept wanting to see him, and he wasn't here one time when the Hawks came, and I thought he was on the farm team, and he just wasn't here.
Yeah, they do give their guys a lot of rest, and they don't necessarily send them all down. I know.
Right.
And you talk about Kenji Otonari, and I keep thinking, man, there's still guys they have in reserve who we really haven't seen yet. We did see Kazuyuki Hoashi. He did throw. Now Higashihama has thrown, I believe.
Yes.
But not a lot. Hiroki Yamada, the lefty, I haven't seen him.
We're not going to see him too much. I don't think they have a very high opinion of his ability to keep the ball in the park when they went to a livelier ball 2 years ago.
Right. But, I mean, Sho Iwasaki, remember,
sure.
He was starting. And they like these guys have pitching for days. And yeah. I could go on. I think the relievers we haven't seen. I can't imagine if you're a starter there and you don't pitch well, what you get told after games, you know? let's say consecutive games you don't pitch well.
The message is pretty obvious. I would be surprised if Sho Takeda wasn't deactivated after last night's three-inning start, because three innings, we had a couple of options for the interview with the Hawks, and one of them was Dennis Sarfate, and John was saying, you know, ask about the length the starters are getting. And I hadn't thought about it too much, and so I, you know, whipped out the database and looked at it, and it's just amazing how much the difference between this year and last, what the Hawks are getting in terms of length. I mean, last year they had, through the first 96 games, they had six pitchers who didn't finish three innings, six starts.
Uh-huh.
They had 38 pitchers who didn't work six innings. This year they've got zero who didn't work three. They've got 22 who didn't. 22 out of 95 pitchers have not gone six innings.
Yeah.
Okay. Last year was like more than a third. This year it's less than a quarter. Yeah. It's a huge difference. It's almost an inning a game. I mean, although the median pitches thrown is almost exactly the same.
Yeah. We could study their pitching and talk about that for days.
Anyway, so I did want to mention that since that was your observation. I thought it was very keen.
Oh, thank you very much. Now, I also like the comment he made about Steve Yonson. And I did talk to Steve Yonson when they had the warm-up games earlier this year in Japan. I think it was March. And he was coaching the international team or the European team against Japan. And we have that interview. Maybe it'll be on the show at some point later this year, maybe before the Premier 12. But I like the statement, the baseball brain. I thought that was really cool.
I thought that was really cool. It was hard for me. As soon as he mentioned the practice, I had this image of the Dutch practicing. And I don't know if I went into this in March. It wasn't the Dutch. It was Steve's practice.
Yeah,
his pitcher's fielding practice. And he's got three coaches lined up back along a line. Somebody behind home plate, one guy to his left and one guy to his right, sort of in the warm-up circles. They're all hitting fungos, and the pitchers on the left side of the infield are throwing one way, and the pitchers on the right are throwing the other way, and the pitchers in the middle are throwing back to second. It's like watching the Harlem Globetrotters, except there's 30 of them out there.
Wow. Yeah.
It's just balls are flying every way, and everything is organized and chaotic at the same time. It's fun. It was fun to watch. I complimented a couple of the players, and Luc van Mil, who was with Rock Ten and with the Dutch WBC team as their closer in 2013.
The 7-footer, yeah.
And I asked him, he says, yeah, you know, we do this every day. we're used to this kind of chaos. And I thought, wow, that's so cool.
I did have one question, though. Why were you asking him if Bert Blyleven had taught him how to scuff the ball? What was up with that?
Well,
what's the goal there? Where are we going with this interview when you do that?
Well,
Oh, yeah. He taught me.
Let's put it this way. I had that in mind because Bert Blyleven, I don't want to say he cheated.
Okay.
And I don't want to say he cheated because every baseball player, if you don't push the limits of legality within the game, you're really not trying hard enough.
Okay.
And almost every pitcher has tricks. And as soon as you said tricks, I thought back to Tom House, the former journeyman major league pitcher with a variety of teams and who was the pitching coach with Bobby Valentine with the Texas Rangers and came over here and worked with a number of Japanese teams, who told me that he taught the old guy, Masahiro Yamamoto, how to throw a scuff ball.
You mean a screwball.
Well, I said, did Tom House teach you to throw a defaced baseball? He said, no. I said, did you ever throw it? Oh, no. Well, of course, what else is he going to say? But I did ask him.
Yeah, okay.
Which was fun. He looked very uncomfortable.
You know how to make people squirm. I was squirming listening to that question. So I mean,
but it was funny because Bert Blyleven is such a big, lively, fun guy.
And he was on the show during that the WBC.
Right. I thought, well, he might have. He might have. Why not?
Why not? Why not? All right, let's talk about the Hawks a little bit. Now, I remember you badgered me for suggesting that the Hawks would have to battle complacency this season, and I think it was in the preview show or maybe even before, because I said they're better than everyone, and it's obvious, and I think they're going to have a lot of talent, and blah, 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 and you said, how could they battle complacency? They haven't even played a game yet. And I'm like, you wait and see. So I'm gonna bring that up because they're, 30-plus games over 500 right now. They're out in front of everybody else in the Pacific League who's playing for second place. And in that respect, we've already seen from the beginning of the season that Kudo has done well at managing all the talent that he has and that the team is just superior to everybody. So I think they have to battle complacency going down the stretch again and worry about that as they go into the playoffs.
I think that's true to the extent now, but I'll tell you, of course, we had a shock result in Chiba this weekend. I mean, they've lost two in a row.
I heard the announcer on the game say, "Yeah, they're winning too much. They've got to make some adjustments."
Well, No, but that's true. But that's true. You have to, it's so much harder to adjust when you're winning than when you're losing. Because when you're winning, the mistakes, although, you know, you always see the Japanese head coaches whose job is to basically take notes of all the mistakes and then remind players of their faults on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. And it's harder when you're winning that some of the faults are not quite as obvious. They're not as obvious to the public.
Right.
But, you know, they have, and it's harder to make the adjustments when you're winning because, you know, in the end, if you're winning, you know, you accomplish the goal. So, and I think that's just a human thing. Mm-hmm. So they have lost twice in a row. Yeah, this could be the start of a, you know, another a horrible end of the season slump like they had last year. But let me tell you, this is the huge difference between this team and the last, I would say the last 4 years of Hawks teams. This is the first team where they've won games to the degree that they should have won. I don't think this Hawks team is particularly any stronger in terms of talent than what they've had the last 4 years. But they're just playing better.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I did see a stat that floated along Twitter from the Newell data site, and it said that through Friday's games that the starters for the Hawks were 47-23.
Okay.
And obviously nobody else in Japan is even close. Mm. The team that rivals them in terms of starting pitchers and their victories was the Giants, whose starters had 38, but they were only 38-35, not you know, 24 games over 500 as a rotation. So that was impressive.
Well, we were talking about the starting. Now, I had trouble when we were talking about managers, and evaluating the Hawks was difficult because they changed the dimensions of the ballpark.
Yes.
And one of the things they did, and I'll tell you, when you look at what the Hawks starters have done this year as composed to what they did as opposed to what they did last year, is basically the only thing that they're basically better at everything except allowing home runs at home.
Right, which makes sense.
And it's like,
I gotta look that up too. I gotta get the basket home runs. I will do that.
I mean, here they've got okay, they went from 0.7 home runs per nine innings at home to 1.07, you know, about a 30% increase. But everything else, so they've got nine complete games through 95 games. Last year they had three all on the road. Their road ERAs dropped by almost a run. Their home ERAs even dropped despite the home runs. Their strikeouts are way up. Their walks are way down. So I have to give, you know, kudos handling of the pitching staff, which at first I was not certain about. I have to give them a big thumbs up on that one.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, I don't know if I gave him the C++ or just a C+, but
you gave him no grade. You gave him a C something. You gave him a no factor. A pass.
I gave him a no factor.
You gave him one of those UC Santa Cruz banana slug.
Well,
no passes.
All right. The horse is dead.
Well, I'm not finished beating it. Don't kill it yet.
In part, I said because he's got so much talent. I want to see what he does when he doesn't have that much talent.
Okay, fair enough.
But that was my only thing with that. But yeah, he's doing a good job of managing a lot of talent. Now, you know, I wanted to ask this question, and I figured you were the perfect person to ask. Why are the Hawks so good? Are they drafting better? Are they just collecting the most Japanese free agents? Because we know they've got some. Uchikawa has been a longtime standout as a free agent. Obviously, Lee Daho and Dennis Sarfate moved over because they were available.
Wolf Standridge,
Toru Hosokawa, who's been a real stable force behind the plate defensively, and that was one of the things I always thought was a sore spot for the
Hawks. Yeah, Kenichi Nakata, Shinya Tsuruoka. So, yeah, they've been a huge free agent buyer, and I think that's sort of like that has helped. That's helped solidify things. The other thing is the Hawks have the best minor league development in Japan.
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they do. They've got a regimen of third team games. All the players, you know, there's no way they're going to get. First of all, they've got like 20 developmental contract guys on their roster. And these guys play against local university teams in Kyushu and independent league teams in Kyushu and club team. You know, they're just not playing every day.
So
the Hawks minor leaguers get a lot of games, a lot more games than you know, shows up in the official NPB records. The Giants and the Marines players also get quite a lot in the Eastern League. But the Hawks get quite a lot, and that's very hard in the Western League because there's only five teams, and the travel is nasty. So that's one reason. They have a very good minor league development. And I'll tell you the other one. When I went to – after I finished talking with Rick Vandenhurk, I just had a brief chat with my buddy Atsushi Toriida, the Hawks physical conditioning coach. And
he was on the show in the offseason.
He was on the show in the offseason, and I always looking to get more stuff from him. But it's almost too good to write. And in fact, if I had written what he told me yesterday, they'd be having teams going, oh yeah, we'll show them. Which was, he came out and I said, how are you guys doing? He said, honestly, I'm afraid for the other teams. And he said that, and I'll tell the listeners what I told you yesterday, or mentioned to you. He said that this year, under Kudo, all the fact-finding and information sharing and listening to the trainers, when guys are frazzled, they get rest. He said players aren't being asked to go to be pushed past their limits just to be in the lineup.
Right.
And he said that the variation of the variance in players' body weights and body mass index and body fat percentages is very little from day to day and week to week. He said the players are rested and healthy. And he said this team's going to be really, really strong as the season progresses.
Yeah.
Because we know that in Japan, this is a huge issue.
And they look that way now. And I wanted to mention before we get off the Hawks here that their magic number is now 37. Say, since 1989, this is the soonest that they've had their magic number. You know, this early August here, in my opinion, it was Thursday the other day, I think it was, or Friday, Thursday or Friday Thursday. Last week. So this is pretty fast. So
And this is not since 1989. It's from long before the Hawks never had it in Fukuoka, is what you're saying, because they moved to Fukuoka in 89, and they were doormats for most of the 70s and 80s and 90s.
Okay.
So.
All right. Well, talking about doormats, our second half doormats have been the Cebu Lions, and they went on a 13-game skid and surpassed their franchise worst in terms of skids that had been 12, and that was set in 1979. So they lost 5-4 on Tuesday in Sendai. But they came back the next day and they ended that ugly, god-awful skid with a 6-1 win over the Rakuten Eagles. And you say Kikuchi was really strong, pitched in the seventh inning. And
I say that as well.
And Takeya, Okawari-kun, Nakamura had 4 hits. Shogo, Akiyama had 3 hits, and each of them had an RBI. And Nesto Mejia had a 2-run single in the ninth and padded the lead and blah, blah, blah. But this was a really ugly skid for this team, and that's and it came on the heels of me saying all kinds of nice things about him. So I really,
yeah, John is just coming around, and I'm going, wow, you know,
keep me away from your team.
yeah. Well, that goes. Yeah, somebody was saying that as well. You know, as soon as we said nice and bad things about the Eagles, and they won like 3 or 4 in a row, and then they went back to in the Eagles, and we were saying nice things about the Lions, and then they went. Turn sour, but they'll probably turn back around. You know, this happens.
Yeah.
This random events. I don't want to say the baseball events are random, but they happen in random fashion.
Right.
So, you know, this happens. 13 games. That's a bad. That's a horrible streak. It's hard to win 13. I'll say this: if you're a good team, it's pretty darn near impossible to lose 13 games in a row. So I think this is not something that just happened.
Yeah.
I have to reevaluate my whole position on the Lions, obviously.
Well, you know, they were outscored 67-26 during the skid. It started on July 15th. Their starters lost 9 of the 13 games, so they were pinned with the loss. They were blank twice. They scored only one run, 4 times. Kishi lost twice, 2-0 and 2-1 in games that I think he pitched. He went the distance and pitched really well.
Yeah, he was the star. He was the star of the streak. and you know went 0-2. So
yeah, Kikuchi lost twice, but he pitched well in his in two of his starts, and I think they lost 4-1 and 8-1 eventually in one of them. So
yeah, the offense suddenly stopped scoring.
Yeah, well, it wasn't
all the offense.
Yeah,
but
they did, obviously when you get outscored 67-26, you're not scoring and you're not doing the other things either. But
and the other thing is that you know, and I know one of our listeners in who's a Tigers fan, Trevor, he loves to point this out because you know I'm big on using teams' ability to score runs and you know the actual runs they score and allow as an indicator of how well they score and allow runs.
Mm-hmm.
And he hates that because the Tigers' winning percentage is vastly better than that.
Right.
He hates that because there's, I mean, it does happen on occasion when, you know, when you get into a team's bullpen, you get into the guys who shouldn't really be pitching much.
Right.
And then they prove why they shouldn't be pitching much.
Yep.
Yeah, that games will occasionally get really, really ugly, you know, and you'll end up giving away 7 runs instead of 1. So it does happen, but we're talking about a small element. But that was part of that, you know, that ugly part of the streak is they were just overloading the bullpen at the, you know, of the bad guys in the bullpen at the 7th and 8th innings.
Well, they are playing in they're playing against Oryx on Sunday, and we'll see how that ends up and how they start out next week. But they're 2-15 right now since July 15th, so that's not good. And I'm not ready to take back what I said about that. I still think they can be a playoff team, but they've fallen behind the Lotte Marines in a situation where they're going to have to play well and beat them head-to-head games when they see them to right the ship for themselves. But I think they can do it. They just, you know, it's going to take the team ever. I mean, just like you said, it happens, and it wasn't all offense, but the offense, you can always point to them not hitting and not hitting with runners in scoring position and not coming through, but you know you got to pitch well too. You got to pitch to those games and the games that Kishi and
pitch Kikuchi to those games, John. Get into the 21st century, man. Pitch to win. If you allow run, don't allow any. And it's
I'm not saying that.
I'm just making fun of the sentence.
I know, but you're in a 4-4 game, you just try to get the next guy out. If you're in a scoreless game, you know, you try to get the next guy out. I mean, it doesn't change, I know, but you've got to keep the ball down. I mean, the games Kikuchi lost, I think he hung a couple breaking pitches and they got
hit
out of the
park. And the other
guys
hit them. Yeah, and the other teams hit the mistakes and the lines didn't hit the chances they had. So it's not...
I know
what you're saying. It's just that dumb one about good pitchers, you know, good pitchers can pitch to the score. And then somebody said that, you know, Yeah, that explains why Madison Bumgarner lost 2-1 today because he's not a good pitcher and he doesn't know how to pitch to the score. I'm going, yeah, right, that's it.
All right, some more notes making a seamless transition. We had balk night on Tuesday night.
Is that special? Do you get a t-shirt?
Yeah, I think you get a free beer with every balk. Yoslan Herrera of the Bay Stars had 3-1 inning. And this was at Nagoya Dome, and the Bay Stars actually came away with a victory, so it didn't cost them the game or anything. But in the 8th inning, he had 3 balks, and that tied a Japanese record, or an NPB record. And the funniest thing about it was when they got out of the 8th inning on the last pitch, I think he got a fly ball or something. Mm-hmm. The funniest thing is you can see the catcher skipper Motonobu Tanishige of the Dragons was throwing his hands in the air as if to say the final pitch of the inning was also a balk, and they didn't call it. And the basic thing was, and I saw two of them, he just didn't have a discernible stop. I mean, he would get in.
Yeah, which is actually a balk as opposed to the normal Japanese balk.
Yeah, yeah.
The normal Japanese balk is where the pitcher does not wait 3 seconds. And you know, in the majors, every pitcher has a routine stop. You know, it could be a second and a half. It could be, you know, if the guy pauses a lot, he's got to pause a lot.
Right.
If he doesn't pause barely at all, then he's got to stick with what's normal for him. Okay. So the what happened? I asked after this happened to a Carp pitcher a few years ago. I think he had 3 balks in 1 game, not in 1 inning. I think it might even have been Chris Brock. I asked Masato Yoshi about this. He said, you know, when I came back from the majors to pitch in Japan, the umpire, I asked the umpires in spring training, God, this is a broken record. We asked the umpires in spring training if this was okay. And they said, sure, it was okay. And then on opening day, I got called on it 17 times. You know, it happens every time. The umpires in spring training are like, yeah, whatever. Go ahead and do what you want.
Right.
It's like, oh, you're screwed. So he said, no, you're not. You know, they said it was okay in spring training if he paused his normal routine. But on opening day, it was, that's not 3 seconds. Get out of here.
Right, right. So,
it happens to all the pitchers in Japan. They got to learn that the umpires don't really follow the rules. They don't follow the rules. They follow their rules.
Their rules. So this record that Herrera tied, it was held or is shared by two other foreign guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you looked them up. I knew Domingo. Yeah.
We knew the second one. The first was neither of us was here. In July 1974, I was finishing junior high school. And he was Tony Lay of the Nippon Ham Fighters against the Buffaloes. And then September 2007, when we were here, former Dragon and Bay Star Domingo Guzman against the Cebu Lions. And then more recently, Mr. Herrera.
Right. Yeah, the record is 4-1 game by Domingo Guzman.
I'm guessing it's the same day.
Yeah, it's September 1st.
Yep.
September 1st, so the same game. So that was interesting. Then the Giants had their 10,000th game in franchise history, and they rallied behind a couple of Shuichi Murata home runs to win at Jingu, so that was good for them.
Can I add some? Somebody was asking me, how come the Giants were not the first team to 10,000 games if they're the oldest pro team in Japan? And not the first pro team in Japan, Giants fans, just to let you know, but the oldest existing one.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know the answer?
No.
And how come they were the fourth? I think they fell behind the Tigers and the Hawks and the Buffaloes. Blue Buffaloes, Blue Wave.
King Tetsu.
Hankyu.
Mixture.
Braves, yeah. And the reason is that in the 1936 season, the Giants started the year when they began the current pro baseball establishment that they created. They weren't here. They were in the U.S. playing games in the U.S. in the spring of 1936. And they came back in the summer when they had the tournaments that year. They had a spring tournament and a summer tournament and a fall tournament. And they began playing in the summer tournament. It was a little round robin format they had.
Okay.
They missed out on like the first 12 games.
That's a good
So idea. All the teams are getting to 10,000. The Giants are sitting there gritting their teeth and going, we were really first.
Not on the scoreboard where it counts, baby.
No, absolutely not. We're oldest. We were here first. You know, we didn't hear a big celebration about that, like it was important. When the Tigers got to 10,000 first, because they played the longer schedule, and the Pacific League teams got there pretty quickly because the Pacific League calendar used to be much longer in the early 60s. So.
All right, well, nothing new about burying the lead. Matt Merton of the Tigers, also on Wednesday, he had 4 hits, and that gave him at least 100 hits in all 6 seasons that he has played in NPB, so congratulations to him. And also, old man Masahiro Yamamoto, and I wish we could have taped in at night to talk about this afterwards, but we'll talk about it next week. Because I'm pretty sure Tanishige is going to catch him tonight or today at the Nagoya Dome. So he's going to get the start today at 49 years and 11 months, and he's almost 50. He might as well.
That's the combined battery age is going to be
95 and a half.
94, yeah, 95 and a half. Wow.
Yeah.
That's ever ready. Man.
All right, well, let's go to fielding questions. All right, the first one comes from at Graveyard Ball, and he says, Logan Andrusik talked about the movie Mr. Baseball briefly on a previous episode. What are your opinions/reviews/thoughts on the movie?
What are your opinions, reviews, thoughts on the movie?
I said previously on previous shows in previous years, I was living in Nagoya at the time of the filming, and I wanted to be an extra and go into the stands and chill with all the other people, but I was working, and I just couldn't wait for the movie to come out. And, you know, it's an adequate adaptation or introduction, I would say, to NPP-style baseball.
Yeah, it shows the Swallows fans doing the umbrellas and stuff, and...
Yeah, there's some memorable lines. I can't say which one is my favorite, but the guy who does the State Farm commercials and who was in 24 playing the president or whatever. I didn't watch 24. Sorry, Kiefer Sutherland. But
He played the teammate. He had the black teammate for Tom Selleck.
And he said the line was something to the effect of, that's why I came here to get away from spoiled, selfish guys like you. And, you know, that was a great line. That's something I remember. And because I kept thinking, well, that's not why you're here. But
indeed, you could have gone to Ned Paul to do that.
Yeah. But it's a nice movie. I mean, you know, many of the game scenes were filmed at Nagoya Stadium, so that brings back a lot of memories for me. And, of course, I haven't seen the game in a long time, but a lot of off-the-field scenes were filmed in Tokyo or Osaka or someplace where they had a skyline, because we didn't really have a skyline in Nagoya at the time, so they had to go somewhere else to film these big city scenes and make it look like it, you know, that.
Yeah, they might have gone to Okazaki or someplace like that to do that.
Yeah, right. No. Yeah. Watch out.
Well, they got a castle on a hill, you know. That picturesque.
But it's a neat story. There's not enough information. Plus, I don't think there's ever been a manager who has that much command of the English language who could actually get along with a foreign player like that. But, you know...
Although we do have managers who have that kind of presence, and I think it's kind of ironic because the guy who makes me think of that kind of manager in that kind of presence is Senichi Hoshino.
Oh, I thought you...
Who was the Dragons manager just before and just after they filmed that movie.
Yeah.
So I don't have too many opinions. It's kind of a screwy movie, but it's, you know, it's a Hollywood interpretation of what Japanese baseball might conceivably look like, you know, and they throw in these little vignettes of things that happen in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And to some respects, that's good. And, you know, we get to see Brad Animal Leslie begin his career as an entertainer in Japan, as opposed to being an entertainer bopping Hankyu Braves catchers on the head. Rest in peace, Mr. Leslie.
Yep.
And a couple of other regulars, you know, we got to see some things in that movie. And one of the interesting stories was, now, the book was to a large extent based on somebody who had read Bob Whiting's The Chrysanthemum and the Bat and You Gotta Have Wah. And when it was... And they had copies. They issued copies of You Gotta Have Wah to the cast and crew when we were filming.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Robert Whiting told me that they paid an indemnity to him so that he would not sue them for stealing his material after they found out that they were using his book as a reference. And I think he wanted it would have been obvious to have him along as a technical advisor, and they decided they were going to try to do it cheap, you know, basically get everything from him through his books.
Right. But that movie, that movie's what, now almost 20 years old, if not more. So
more.
Should probably be updated. I think NPB has changed a lot, but it's a good watch and it was fun. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Well, thanks for the question.
All right. Our next one is from our buddy Glenn in Tokyo. And I gave this question to the producer and he cut it down a little bit. So apologies, Glenn. He says, the discussion about Tanishige's games played record was interesting. It actually made me wonder how many bench warmers had ridden the pine while Tanishige had been holding down the full-time job in Yokohama and Chunichi. And he said he looked over the records. He said he saw 9 with Yokohama and he saw about 12 with Chunichi. So his question is, which players have you seen over the years had the talent to be regulars or even stars in the league, but just never got the chance to come off the bench enough to show what they could do? And he said he remembered a guy named Takeshi Omori who hit 2 home runs for the Giants in the 1996 series against Oryx, but never got more than 48 at-bats in an 8-year career.
Well, I have a question for you, Gwen, and it's did you read my old guides when I was publishing those things in the 90s? Because Omori was one of my favorite players. And he was one of my favorite players. He was the epitome of why the Giants in the 90s were the Giants in the 90s. They were all about big name star players. And as much as I love Motoshi Fujita, who was Omori's first manager, Fuji, he didn't have a good spring his first year. He gave him a few at bats on the first team. He didn't fit. He didn't do well. And that was it. He was consigned to the minors, where he became, I wouldn't hesitate to say, he became the best minor league hitter in Japanese baseball history. He was the Buzz Arlett of Japan. Now, you can look up Buzz Arlett, anybody, and find out who he was. And tremendous hitter. I mean, this was he was an Ichiro caliber, a hitter of Ichiro Matsui caliber hitter in the minors.
High praise.
He was in that. This is a guy who just raked every year in the Eastern League. Led the Eastern League in home runs by a good margin, led the Eastern League in RBIs and on-base percentage by a good margin, huge offensive winning percentages. And the Giants just wouldn't use him because he was a reject. And he's rare in the sense that these guys usually get a chance somewhere. But because the Giants kept him on the farm team and didn't trade him until after he injured his shoulder and needed surgery when he was like 30 years old. He played a 5 or 6 games with the Kintetsu Buffaloes after he had shoulder surgery. So the final story on Takeshi Omori is, of course, that he came back and he's had a huge impact with the Giants as a scout. He's ostensibly, he's the guy, or so Wikipedia says, you know, as I told Rick, my Wikipedia is my God. And Wikipedia credits him with convincing the Giants to go after this infielder from Tohoku after they failed to get Masahiro Tanaka in the first round of the amateur draft. And this guy that they needed convincing was this shortstop named Hayato Sakamoto.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's the case, then he's more, you know, he's almost made up, you know, he's given the Giants vastly more than they ever gave him.
For me, I don't always judge on one instance. So I remember as soon as I saw that 2 home runs in the Japan series, I thought of John Bowker because he's the guy who really produced in the Japan series, but didn't really have a lot to do over the long haul, and his numbers weren't great and impressive, and he was in and out of the lineup for the Giants. But I tend to believe that some guys fall through the cracks. It's just like the justice system anywhere. Some guys are going to be really talented and they're going to fall through the cracks. But if you're good enough, if you can play, if you can hit normally, if you're not on a team stacked with too much talent like the Hawks are right now, they're going to find room for you. They're going to push you to a different position, or they're going to push someone else out of your position and get you on the field because you're too productive. But
well,
with that said, I think there's some guys I've seen through the years. I know this is one of your guys, Ryota Arai of the Dragons and now Tigers. He just couldn't get any playing time with the Dragons, and they traded him, and he got some playing time at spots.
Yeah, by the time he's 28 years old.
but he's still a productive guy. He comes off the bench and does well on occasion. I think Tatsuyuki Uemoto is a catcher for the Lions. I think he's just in the wrong position, and he's just got no wheels and can't do very much else. And
Okada's the same.
And he's just not going to get a lot of time. But I always thought he could hit. I remember him winning a game with a walk-off home run. I can't remember if it was a slam or not, but 3 or 4 years ago, and I kept
thinking, there are other issues with Uemoto, who's a very big friendly guy, but he's got some other issues to
deal. Yeah, okay, but I mean, you know, I always thought that maybe if he had a chance he could play in the long run. But
most of those guys are guys with limited defensive options.
That's the problem.
And as far as, you know, and I was a big fan of Omori, and to say he was a great hitter is, you know, you can say, well, no, he never proved it to the top level. But the guys who hit as well as Omori did were, and I don't think Takeshi Yamasaki was as good a hitter as Omori was.
Huh. that's saying a lot.
And they're very similar in that they never got a and Yamasaki's a guy who didn't get a chance to start regularly until he was 27. And the first chance he got, he won the Central League batting title. This is a guy who should have been the Dragons' starting first baseman when they lost Ochiai. And the guy who should have been the Giants' first baseman instead of signing Hiromitsu Ochiai was Omori.
Mm-hmm.
But the Giants had to have a big name. And I don't think Ochiai was any better of a hitter at that stage in his career. He was a good hitter. Omori was a tremendous hitter. And what keeps them back is this belief that you can see what people do in 50 at-bats.
Yeah.
You know, and the Giants not, you know, he was a failure. We're not going to use him. I could go on and on, but you're correct in the sense that most of these guys, as you mentioned, we were talking before, Kazuhiro Wada was a guy who produced, but they didn't like him as a catcher. They didn't like him as an outfielder. But he eventually got it. And Yamasaki eventually got a job twice when he was done. You know, right. He was done when he was 25 and he got another chance. But he was with teams that needed, you know, he ended up in Rakuten. Well, who needed talent more than Rakuten? I can think of a half dozen guys. Ichiro Suzuki, because he was an outfielder and he was fast, he got a chance to play again when he got a new manager. I mean, if Masahiro Doi had continued, or excuse me, Shozo Doi had continued to be his manager at Oryx, Ichiro Suzuki would have been the guy who was traded and got a chance to play when he was 27.
Yeah. I think a guy we're looking at right now who probably can play and had a lot of weight on his shoulders at the beginning of the season for the Giants is Taishi Ota, who I really,
sure.
really like.
I do. You know, and I like him. I said bad things about him, and I don't mean bad things personally about him. I said bad things about his numbers. And the reason I did is because the Eastern League is a funny league. The Eastern League is a hitter's league, and so I tend to discount the Eastern League numbers a little bit. But when I discount them, I should say the Eastern League is like the Pacific Coast League in the United States. It's two different leagues. It's Kamagaya, where the Fighters play, and it's Lotte Urawa, where the Marines players play. And then it's the rest of the league, which is a good hitters, and then we have the stratosphere.
Right.
Marines players and Fighters players play in a park that seriously inflates their offense, playing parks. And the other teams play there, and they play they're affected by that, but not to the degree those teams are. And I looked at Taishi Oda's numbers, and I said, yeah, that's okay, but not really for the Eastern League. But the Giants Park is not a big hitter's park, and his numbers were actually quite respectable.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Glenn. We appreciate it. Anyone else who wants to send a question, send it via email to yakyujohn@gmail.com. Tweet us at #HighHeat. At JBW Podcast, or you can go to the Facebook page and leave us a comment there. Good to have you back, buddy. Missed you last week, and looking forward to talking to you again next week.
Good to be back. Have a nice day after this early morning wake-up call.
All right.
And, talk to you folks next week.
Enjoy your baseball. One World Sports is the exclusive home of the Yomiuri Giants in North America and features live coverage of all Giants home games. Please contact your local cable provider to find out how you can watch One World Sports.